bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey!
Ryan Brushwood.
Yo-ho!
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
First off, we're recording on, it is Martin Luther King Day, and so I think we should at least mention that, you know, the celebration of the life of somebody who did a lot to unite us, and I think that it's worth remembering that, so would not want to proceed without at least calling attention to that, so.
Yeah, you know, I've been reading a lot about, for the Raise the Dead podcast, 1960, 1964, and by proxy 1968, and that really is the kind of rise and the peak of his powers of Martin Luther King, and specifically in 1964, running up to the Civil Rights Act. There's a lot of, I would encourage people to read about Martin Luther King as he was written about, as that was going on, as that summers in 1963, 1964, are boiling over, and really did the difference of how much of a difference he made in terms of making nonviolent protests something that was not only the most effective, but also something that he positioned as it is honoring the law to break it with full knowledge of the consequences and then immediately suffer them so you can bring attention to an unjust law. And I think that is, especially for that time, when you understand what, you know, how differently things could have gone, that was something truly revolutionary, and I would encourage folks to pay more attention to that.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the most important lessons of history is the idea that in democracies, the nonviolent protest is the way to show you kind of have the moral higher ground. You know, once you reject the use of violence, but put yourself in line and do civil disobedience, et cetera, but reject violence, it's hard to be called the bad guy.
Yeah.
When you're doing that. So, there we go. So, gentlemen, hearing explodey things last night or day before or yesterday?
I mean, I don't know why I would. We got home, we took it easy, we watched a movie. I did watch the movie 1917, which I thought was a fine film. There was a lot of explodey things on that, but from the nature of your tone, I assume there's something else I should have heard.
We had a planned explosion by SpaceX and NASA yesterday as they blew up a Falcon 9.
Oh, wait.
Midair.
This is the thing where they were testing the thing that will save the crew if things go explodey.
Right. So they have part of the Crew Dragon test program. They have the Dragon capsule with the Crew Dragon, which goes on top of the Falcon 9. And it's designed as, you know, needs to have an abort system, an escape system. That's one of the things that NASA requires for spacecraft, not named the space shuttle, that they have is this some sort of escape system. And in order for Boeing and SpaceX to qualify, they've had to do different demonstration tests to show this. And SpaceX was like, yeah, we'll do our crew abort test, and we'll put it on top of a Falcon 9. We'll blow up the Falcon 9, and we'll let this thing escape. And it went off great. They actually did it, like, I think, like 7 a.m. yesterday, whatnot. And at about 100,000 feet up in the air, this thing separated. The Falcon 9 blew up. There's some really wonderful footage out there of it because there were so many people out there with their cameras and their telescopes trying to capture it. And the Crew Dragon separated and then basically went through, coasted for a while, then parachutes ejected and deployed, rather. It'd be bad if they ejected.
Holy cow. God, I've never seen this footage. That is an extraordinary explosion. Wow. I mean, look, it's not a contest, but that seems to be a much bigger explosion than we saw when the Challenger disaster happened. I mean, that's extraordinary. What? Am I wrong?
So It was an amazing explosion. And if I have to write, yes, nobody died in this one, so it is a better explosion. And it is was a very great, you know, a good test of this thing, a good test to see, you know, how things would handle in this. The first stage, as you saw, got annihilated. And then the upper stage, actually, like, there's footage of that thing just sort of like descending and still making its way down until it probably just crashed into the ocean.
So do they like strap on an actual explosive device, or how does one initiate an explosion for this kind of simulation?
I think that in this case, just this, the separation system itself might cause it, just by like when you fire a bunch of, you know, your rockets at the other end of it. And then what happens with the rocket itself is once it loses that nice narrow dynamic nose of the escape of the capsule, all of a sudden all that aerodynamic pressure just impacts the rocket. So I think that it just might be enough to just separate it.
This is remarkable. And the first thing that comes to my mind is, like, if you really want to get that NASA money, like, Brian, you just went through this with the new building where it's like, all right, you have all this adrenaline that goes into like buying a new structure, right? And then you realize, like, and of course you realize, all right, it's going to take a lot of money to get this up to snuff. Like, obviously we're going to have to put some investment in. And so you partition some money and you go forward, but it's always more than you think, right? And I can only imagine that at some point during the process of SpaceX being like, all right, look, cheap rockets, we can launch them. We can launch them safe. We can launch them with people. Whatever you need, we got it here for you at SpaceX. And then at some point down the road, they're like, yeah, okay, so where's the one that explodes on purpose? It's like, oh, wait, we need one that, because these are expensive, guys. I mean, like, that's a lot. I mean, I know we're doing them cheaper for you, but like, it's, yeah. No, sorry, it's in the contract. You just need the one that we explode on purpose. And also, you're going to need another one for my son's bar mitzvah. You know, it's just, he's just a big fan. So if we can throw in, let's just do an even five explodey rockets on purpose. But don't worry, you're eventually going to get this sweet NASA money that will be more money than you could ever count forever.
And we'll fill them with glitter. one of the best jokes I heard was, because apparently Elon Musk's girlfriend Grimes is pregnant, and apparently by Elon, was maybe it was a missed opportunity to do a gender reveal.
Yes!
Yeah, turns out the gender of the child is money, government money, lots of it.
Well, apparently at this point, SpaceX has probably spent more than they've made on the program, but looking towards long term, they'll, you know, likely come out ahead. But because remember, they got half as much as Boeing got. And, you know, Boeing apparently couldn't afford a bolt to attach one of their parachutes for the last thing, or a guidance system on the mission, the other mission. So it's hard. All this is hard. I would dump on Boeing. Yeah, I think it's okay now, actually. They've done enough that we can dump on them without feeling bad. But
you want to know what? I think they'll be fine. I think that's some mean words of people on a podcast. I think that Boeing, they've proven it, that they're going to tough this one out, little tykes.
Well, you know, the hard part, it's more like when you're a talented person working for those companies and you are very good at what you're doing, you're good wherever you are at your job, and then you have management, other people make bad decisions, it's demoralizing. And then to hear people like me go, wow, this company did this. And then there's somebody's like, hey, I did my job, jerk. What do? You just, you know, make up stuff and write it down. So that's why I always sort of feel bad, because I think about, you know, the rank and file people who work in these companies who are extremely talented. And so it feels bad, you know, where some bad decisions affect them.
That's how I feel, sure, when I tear apart movies on cord killers. I remind myself that human beings worked on this thing.
Yeah, but I'll tell you about, here's the thing about movies, though, where you shouldn't feel as bad. Most of the people get to move on to another one, and so they're not attached. You know, if you were, you know, the set designer on this movie, like, yeah, that movie stunk, but then I worked on this other movie next, which was great. Whereas if you work for a company for the next 30 years, it's got a bad rep. It's like, that's it.
There's always this moment in any television that I've been a part of, or the commercial stuff that I did with Brian, where when you're on the set and everybody's like really nice to you and everything, and it's super fun. And then like at the end, they're like your friends for a period of time, and then you get to the end and you're like, man, I really hope that this thing becomes a thing. And they're like, yep, me too. And then you just know that there's a detachment that I'm sure that it is, from their perspective, it's necessary, right? You can't get attached to everybody. You can't fall in love with every puppy you see at the pound, right? Because you can only, it's out of your control which one happens. But there's always that moment where, like, when you're leaving, you're like, oh, no, wait, you're just off to the next one, and I'll just be sitting here waiting to see whether or not this happens again, and we become best friends forever, or I just never speak to you again.
It's like, this is my moment. Now is about me. And they're like, yeah, same as the last 20 people we worked with on shows.
Exactly, right?
That nobody cares.
There's definitely that moment. That moment where you're like, hey, man, great working with you. And for you, it's like, oh, dude, I just made this connection. This is great. Like, these are my new Hollywood friends. And they're like, yeah, cool. Anyway,
the perverse part is that feeling only arrives at the very end of the project. Once made it through the unbeatable journey, like you're suddenly like, we did it. And now I can bother to care about you as a human being. And they're like, that's great. The perfect time, as I emotionally divorce myself from everything we've done for the last few weeks.
Yeah. Fame is a fickle thing. And I remember, Every day you get a new lesson in this. And I was at a friend's house. They have a nice big piece of property, and they made some comment like, oh yeah, we own a little partial down there. There's a trailer there. I'm like, oh, okay. And they go, such and such star from some TV show in the 80s lives in there now. And you're like, oh geez. You're like, oh, you know, well, the view's great. you're like, wow, this is depressing. I'm gonna go back home to Florida and write books. Unless there's more, another trailer available.
Yeah.
So that's good news though, by the way. So what's next is the next up is to put actual crew onto the Dragon capsule.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. We got the first humans that are gonna test this capsule, right?
Yep. And maybe as soon as March, they think they'll have hardware ready by March. We'll see when that happens. And if that goes well, then wonderful. And, you know, hopefully we can get the Boeing Starliner. You know, that's going to proceed along. And, you know, we'll have two new options for getting people into space from American soil. And that's sort of the big, you know, Jim Bridenstine, the head of NASA, says, you know, American astronauts and American hardware launching from American soil. Which you'd be like, it sounds a little bit jingoistic. Like, it's NASA. It's funded by America. You know, you kind of, you know.
So was there any setback to, I remember a year or change ago that we were worried that the testing of the escape mechanism, you know, the fact that the capsule exploded or whatever, would be a big setback for getting us using, us being Americans, using the SpaceX to get people up to orbit. I guess it turns out that all that was A-okay.
Well, so what happened was they did the test of the first test to actually send a Crew Dragon up into orbit, and it came back down. And actually, it was the one that docked, I think, at the space station and came back down, and which was cool. Like, I actually went for the launch of that, which is pretty amazing. And then when they went to go test it afterwards, they filled it back up with they have these hypergolic fuels, which are the ones they use to escape really quickly. They're hypergolic because basically they don't need igniters. Once they touch, they just blow up. Which they're super powerful, but they're super dangerous. So they put hypergolic fuels on it, and they put this thing on the test stand, and they started shaking it, and it blew up. They went through, and they found out that the reason it blew up was that normally in an escape system like that, you have a valve once it opens, it permanently opens. It never closes. Because this was designed to be reusable, they had a valve that would open and shut. And when they went to put fuel in there, they had a leakage between one section and the other, and that caused it to go explodey. And so SpaceX like, well, we won't make this part reusable. We'll just put a one-way valve on there like everybody else uses. So, you know, effectively mitigating that problem. And NASA says, yeah, we're cool with that. You know.
So basically by changing the intention, they essentially undid the problem at that point.
Yeah, because it was, you know, they were building these things to be fully reusable. And that's the problem, is that, which is great, but, you know, whenever you put humans on stuff, you want to be testing this hardware hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times to find every situation. And when you take something like this and you dump it into the ocean, you might get mild corrosion or issues you're not aware of. There's a lot of factors that affect that. And so this was a sort of thing like, hey, we have this reusable part. And like, yeah, not so much right now. So. But it's scary. It's just one of those examples of like you think you have everything done. They remember SpaceX has done dozens of launches of sending capsules to the station and back with parachute systems where we're all, you know, all this, but they added, you know, the new systems, the escape systems and all that, which puts these hypergolic fuels on board, which adds a layer of complexity that, you know, it's hard to test for that without just launching hardware. You know, I heard it best put like NASA's approach is like, you do all the paper tests, all the simulations, everything you can, and then you do a couple launches. Where SpaceX attitude's been like, let's just launch a bunch of stuff, see what blows up, then figure out how to fix it. Which,
yeah,
good pros and cons to either one. So I have a question. Did any of you get to see that the Segway chair? Have we seen more of that? The whole.
I only saw the chatter on Reddit that basically whittled everything down to the WALL-E chair. Once you say the words the WALL-E chair, everybody thinks they know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So we're watching a little bit of video of this. So Segway, years ago, one of the things they'd been working on besides the scooter had been like a wheelchair that was going to like a two-wheeled wheelchair. Looked really cool. I don't know how big of a production that ever turned into. But now they revealed this other sort of chair that, like, as Brian distinctly described it, is the WALL-E chair. And it's this two-wheeled sort of chair. You hop in, and it drives you around. What's the advantage of this is that, like, it can probably go pretty good distances. It's extremely agile, whatnot. And it's silly, yet it's still a very futuristic sort of idea. And when I saw this, I started thinking about conversations, you know, we had like 20 years ago when the Segway came out, was, is there a opportunity for some form of motorized transportation that's maybe safer than a scooter and maybe slightly larger, that for cities and stuff, where we say, hey, we want to get rid of cars or we want to do this, but we want to have some way to get you from point A to point B that's modular, that it's not the same as public transit. You know, do we need, I mean, is that something we would be advantageous or be cool?
I mean, certainly it would be cool as hell, cozy as hell, fun as hell. The question I would instantly ask is it healthy as hell? Like, our bodies, we were just talking about, you know, space travel, and the biggest problem we have is that we don't bang up our bodies enough while we're in zero gravity or whatever. And so likewise, I wonder if the downside to a WALL-E chair is that, you know, we're not moving our meat enough and getting those thousands of microfractures that build, you know, stronger bones.
Well, I'm not talking a substitute for walking. I'm talking like a substitute for like Uber, you know, like.
Yeah, I think that we are at a fascinating inflection point for these kinds of devices, and there's a reason why. Who knows where the economic model is going to land? But like, for me, I love those stupid rent scooters. I use those rented scooters like multiple times a week. And when Brian and Bryce are here, I will encourage them to use them if we are around my neighborhood, because it's so easy to get downtown in a way that I wasn't able to do with, or it would cost more with a Uber. And right now the battery power and the speed on those devices are enough that you feel like you are getting there faster, right? I think that we are at a point now where they are light enough and fast enough, and the battery power is robust enough that you can get where you need to go and back, that like there's something there, because if you just need to go, if basically you have a compelling reason to go
3 miles from where you are, right? And that's annoying in a car. It's annoying to find parking. Like, then one of these items is going to fill that need.
Yeah, by the way, O'Brien, I agree that, like, if we use motorized transportation everywhere, that would be detrimentally bad. But you've kind of sold me on the idea of having one of these chairs right at my desk right now, and I could just be like, all right, guys, I'm going to go get a Slurpee. I maybe want to subscribe to this future, Brian. I'm sorry.
No, I understand.
I mean, aside from the fact that everybody bags on Wally. Oh, Wally's where we're headed. What? You mean where our technological advances, even as we mismanage them, wind up saving humanity? Like, it seems to me like a beautiful future where we can get as fat as we want. And as long as, like, eventually our brilliance from the past will come and save us. There is no limit to the indulgence we can have on technology is the moral of the story of Wally. Spoilers for Wally.
Yeah. Cockroaches are likable.
I do. I also feel like, look, man, if we're at that level of complexity and scientific achievement, then we also have a pill that makes us all gorgeous at all times. I mean, I'm not really worried about us becoming.
Yeah, we're all gonna freeze our abs until we have them, and you know that'll be what it is.
I think scooters can be helpful. I'm one of these people that's constantly frustrated though by, like, going every time I go to try a crosswalk in certain parts of, like, North Hollywood, they're just literally blocking the path and stuff. And I just think they need to be more mindful about that. That's my annoyance with those. It's just that the casual way in which they're just, you try to walk around some of the sidewalks here and you're like, oh, wow, somebody just left this here.
Quick side jag on this topic. Do you think that, let me put it this way. I suspect that this is a 100% probability. It's only a question of when. When do you think that self-driving cars are so prevalent that the new hot game for teenagers to play is to jump out in front of cars on a dare for each other? 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? What do you think?
Excluding Russia?
Yeah. Russia, it's already happening. It's fine.
Yeah. I'm sure we're going to get all kinds of stupidity and stuff whenever you see a thing like that. I'm sure. Just a side note, one of the advantages of something like this, by the way, of this mobility thing is scooters are cool, but I'm not going to put my parents on them. You know, I'm not going to be like, hey guys, let's go see Oakland, hop on your scooter, mom. And finding some alternative to that would be useful. But Brian, to what you brought up about that, you know, one of the things that Elon Musk says the Tesla is going to be doing is the car itself will start talking to pedestrians.
Oh, like shouting at them on your behalf?
Well, maybe more friendly, but yeah, it'll be like, hey, what's going on?
Hey, I'm driving here. Yeah.
I did. One of the advantages of going on road trips is you get to, you know, when you rent a car, oftentimes it's the latest generation of whatever is happening in cars. And in this case, I want to say it was a Ford Expedition we were driving. They really do have those set up in what feels like a trench. It's very hard to accidentally move out of your lane on there because unless you signal, I intend to change lanes, it will fight you, which I thought was really wild. And I couldn't decide if I thought that was a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, it was in one where the seat kept vibrating randomly. And I didn't know what it was until I realized it was whenever there was a car in my blind spot.
No
the
kidding.
Seat would vibrate on the side. Yeah, which that's kind of like fat. It was like when I got the Tesla. They're like, here you go. Here's your car. You're like, well, now what? You drive it away. Like, I know nothing about electric cars. I know nothing. And, you know, you just sort of you get in. And it was easy, but you're just that kind of like, and it worked. And that's when you find these new features. Sometimes it can be like, I don't understand these things, but they're usually in, you know, all vehicles are pretty well thought out, but the vibrating thing was a little bit of,
folks, you want to know what else is really well thought out? Your support of us at patreon.com/weirdthings. That is of course where you can make sure that this show continues to rock and roll into the future. I mean, we started doing this podcast. There wasn't no a financially viable SpaceX company, let alone one that's blowing up rockets just to impress its new buddies at NASA, huh? That's why you need to head on over here. We've been there. We'll be there in the future. Patreon.com/weirdthings get you your own RSS feed to make sure that you get this show before anybody else. Head on over there right now. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
So this is another technology related thing. And I want to talk about this because I don't know. There was sort of this breathless piece in the New York Times, which talked about a company called Clearview AI. And Clearview AI, which there are some practices there, which, you know, the way in which the company operated, which, you know, may give you pause or whatever. But essentially what it is, it's a service that they sell to law enforcement. And let's say somebody gets into a fight, somebody captures a cell phone, you know, photo of one of the people in the fight. They don't know the name. Clearview AI lets you take the photo and then upload it to their server, and then it compares it to all these images that people have posted to social media, and it might come back and say, hey, this is a 99% match for so-and-so, you know, for Justin Robert Young, known bar brawler, you know, and then
yeah.
Police might go knock on your door and be like, hey, Justin, were you in a fight? Yeah, I was. Okay. You know, case closed. So that's the idea behind the tech, is that it basically allows you to find, identify people from their social media stuff. And the article came out, and it's, you know, been people talking about, you know, how much is this a violation of our rights, whatever, how dangerous this, how scary this is, whatever. And, you know, my personal takeaway was like, one, I assume this had been a thing years ago. This was the plot line of like Angel Killer, right? I just described basically what was already being done. You had services like TenEye and whatnot, which did reverse image lookup, which was a thing 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And the idea there would be a more sophisticated version of that doesn't surprise me. And I'm not alarmed, but how do you guys feel?
I instantly think of, and I do want to have a discussion about where we are right now, but the moment I read this, I instantly think of what the next step is. And it's like, if we're at a place where AIs are matching faces to social media profiles, then I instantly want to leap ahead into pre-crime territory. The idea that it's like, well, I mean, certainly certain behaviors and the type of things that you say have a strong correlation to, you know, future violent activity or whatever. I don't know. In so many ways, I feel like all we're doing is virtualizing that which we've always done, which is in a small town, everybody knows your face and your name, and then they see you do a thing. Then you go to a bigger town, and it's harder to track that. And now we're just catching up. So weirdly, we're going back in time to where no matter how big the city is, everybody knows your face and what you tend to do.
Well, partly it's, look, internet sleuthing is as old as the internet. Right. And whenever a thing happens, there's a mysterious person that does something, specifically something that is disagreed with a large portion of the internet, or something truly violent or odious or something like that. What's the first thing? Find them, get them. Like, and so you start to see the process of people each pitching in their little bit of information. And that's why we find out who these people are as soon as possible. In a lot of ways, it's natural. This, however, is obviously just a codified version of it. For my money, I'm with Andrew. Like, I think this is just the byproduct. This is just, you know, as soon as we had reverse lookup, we were going to have this.
Well, you know, it's a feature on Bing where if you click on an image of somebody, it will do a record. Like if you click, it looks like, okay, I typed in Weird Things Podcast, went into Bing, typed in Weird Things Podcast. And one of the images came up was a screen grab. My name wasn't on it. I clicked on it and I clicked, looks like Andrew Main, just right there. Like, hey, guess what? You know, like, why are we yelling at this company when like Microsoft does this and it's freely available?
Yeah, here would be the devil's advocate position, is that we do have in society a line between public figures and non-public figures. And even if we are to generously expand what a public figure is to anybody who willingly puts out a podcast, right, a free medium, that doesn't include somebody who, got into a fight on the street, right? Like that would now, we would now have the veracity to find these people in the same way that we would if they willingly put themselves out there as an entertainer.
I think that line is really hard to drive, and I do not think the algorithm behind Bing is doing, saying, hey, we think this is a public person, this is not a public person. It just looks at, it indexes wherever that image and that face has been attached. And also the public person thing is getting harder because it's like some people do not choose to be public and their names are made public because they're a victim of something or what have you.
Yeah.
My point kind of larger is just like, I typed in the name of our high school and it's, just cause I want to see like, oh, were there photos that some photographer grabbed of high school students? And yes. And then it will say, looks like so-and-so who's a player on a high school football team. This is a minor, and I think I have no issue with this, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, I have no issue with this because I think, this is the future we look like. So like, I'm looking at like, there's a photo, somebody took of, a YouTube of a couple high school football player kids and it's identifying them.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think like to Brian's point, like, yeah, we did a thing like this before. You looked around, you said, hey, do you know who this is? When we start posting stuff on social media, we putting this stuff out there. That's not available. It's there. People will know. And I don't know. I guess.
So then let me ask you a question. Is posting anything on social media your declaration that you are a public figure?
While you noodle that out, I think that Justin has stabbed right at the heart of this thing, which is that separation of public versus private figures. I think it's got to go. Not that it should go, but I think it's going. Like I don't see any way to preserve that fantasy. And I believe it's always been a fantasy, but we've never had to publicly acknowledge it before.
There's also a difference between being a public figure and just being someone in public, right? There are laws about like photography and stuff that even if you're a citizen, just, Joe Schmo, if you are in public, there are things that people are allowed to do with your likeness. Cops are allowed to track you in public. You can have your photograph taken as various laws dictate. But that doesn't mean that you're a public figure. Does having a public post make you a brand, or does it just mean that you're someone on a sidewalk?
I think that's one of the things that has been so agonizing. Recently, we did an episode of The Modern Rogue where we were talking about how to preserve your privacy. And we got a lot of folks, I think it's safe to say, under the age of 20, who literally didn't understand our thesis. They're like, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why would you care about your privacy? I literally don't understand the question. But on the flip side, I think all of those same people would find it very, very creepy if from the moment you walked out your front door, somebody very obviously walked right behind you everywhere you went and watched over your shoulder everything you did. Or and then that person was to turn around and for money get paid to report on all those things for you. But there's something about the viscerality of the in-person experience that doesn't seem to translate to the internet experience.
Yeah, I agree the difference is eroded completely. And there's court cases have been have been about that where they've had to decide, was this person a public or not? When did they do this, did this make them public, et cetera? And yeah, it's like the 20-year-old perspective, it's the benefit of having a very short past. Is that, when you're 25 and you go into the job interview and you see on the screen the photos of you doing, keg stands and stuff, with the interviewer, then you're like, oh, now I get the point.
Sure.
And I'm not saying
now in my mid-40s, it's the question of like, I don't do any searches on medical questions in any way that can be tracked on my Google account. I make sure to open an incognito browser, use DuckDuckGo or whatever, because we live in a world where, your insurance provider can decide, well, that creates a pattern that I'm not comfortable with. Beep, bop, boop.
Well, they're forbidden by law to use that, but
and I'm sure they respect that.
I'm sure they do, actually, because one, I don't think they're sophisticated enough to do that, and also the potential litigation of that would be catastrophic.
No, no, because... The issue is not now. I agree with Andrew that there are laws that I think they would have to respect unless they want to face tremendous scrutiny by the government if that were brought to light. However, down the road, when they're like, oh, we'd offer you a steep discount on your rate if only you do this, and now you have to make the decision of, all right, well, do I retroactively turn over all of the every internet search that I've made related to health so I can get a better rate for my children? Now you're in a situation.
And it's not even a matter of your searches too. It's a matter of just your behavior. Like, I don't know how the Google News algorithm works, but in general, I'm going to assume that it pays attention to what types of stories you tend to click on. And for whatever reason, as a crazy libertarian, I am genuinely fascinated by watching the rollback of prohibition of marijuana in the United States. But I wouldn't blame anyone for looking at my search history for thinking that I'm a hardcore stoner as a result of that. I don't know where it ends.
I hear you. Like, I did the same thing, medical stuff. Cause I did look, like I mentioned before, like I have eczema and I did a search for that. And I got the most intrusive advertising you can imagine for weird treatments and stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is why I got to do this private search. I got a cut. Like, I cut my hand on a can of chili. I got myself a good old-fashioned gash. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to search for this in incognito mode because, I don't know. I've just become like you. I just, with you, Brian, it's like, I'm not worried about that case, and I may be wrong on that, but like, there's all these other ones.
Keep in mind, of course, we're experiencing all this from a place of extraordinary privilege, where we're doing it to avoid customized ads. But meanwhile, so many people are doing. They need to engage in this level of privacy discretion because they're quite literally their lives depend on it.
Yeah. That's certainly true and frightening to think. So. You know, we're curious always to hear what everybody else thinks about this too. And the point was, I read that story. I'm like, well, yeah. I'm like, I described in one of my books, like how you build that system. Not like, oh, I foresaw this, because it's such a basic, like, image scraping, all this. It's very, if you get into low level, like, you know, server, you know, doing Python scripts and stuff like this, tutorials will teach you like, oh, how to scrape, you know, Google, or for this image, or build us a web spider, how to do this. It's a very low level, simple thing to do. And that somebody went out there and scraped a bunch of stuff from Facebook and Twitter of images and attached names to it. It's been done a lot. And then the New York Times article was like, oh, this is, and it's like, I'm like, they illustrate several cases where cops were able to find people based on this. I'm like, sounds good to me. You know, we've had reverse image search forever, and this is a better version of that. The question is, you know, should data, you know, what happens? Because like, there are laws, there's policies being put in place, because like, now to me, it's harder to scrape Facebook data. But if your face was on Facebook prior to a certain point, that database is out there.
Well, and we've talked about this before, but it's like, I am waiting for the reckoning of analog photos from the 1960s, where all of a sudden you're able to pinpoint, let's say, Hillary Clinton at these seven different rallies in the background of whatever, with a 97% likelihood of a perfect match or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's only a matter of processing power at this point. Like, it's only a matter of people making an issue of it. And from somebody that has spent a large portion of last year and continuing into this year, finding archival sound and video for the Raise the Dead podcast. Let me just tell you, folks, it's all there. Like, I go through these books and I'll just mark these things of like audio, 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 audio. It's remarkable how much everything is uploaded somewhere. Even if it's some random like re-air that C-SPAN'd it. Like, I found clips from the 1960 election on the C-SPAN website, in one of the jankiest web players that I have seen this side of real player back in the late 90s. But God damn it, if they did not have a re-air from like 94 of the 1960 convention. Like there's wow. there's no stone unturned, and we are only turning over a frightening amount of new stones every day.
And one of the things that's interesting too is our ability to take things that are degraded and improve the quality using algorithms is amazing. You look at like Photoshop, one of the apps released a new like tool for like improving the resolution of stuff. And you know, it comes from taking millions and millions of images and looking at different scales and being able to figure out, well, we kind of know if this human skin is blurry like this, this is really what it looks like. And I'll add a detail. They're doing the sound stuff, whatever. Oh, this is a startup, which we should talk about, Resemble.ai. We've talked about before about the Adobe had that Voco, which was their system for like replicating human voice.
Sure.
Resemble.ai is now offering a platform where you can clone your voice and you can use it to generate your own, you know, content. And so they have examples. So if you go to the examples, these are all computer generated versions of these people speaking to these celebrities.
So here we go. Here's Ellen DeGeneres. How about we do Ellen DeGeneres?
The worst part of my job is flying around the world, being away from my family just to record 10 minutes of audio for an ad.
Wow.
Oh my God.
how about John Hamm?
We focus on positive themes like friendship, self-sacrifice, and fighting for the greater good.
And Coca-Cola like ads.
I mean, like, that's remarkable. Like that you can just do text-to-speech and... in fact, actually, here, let me ask you guys. And I'm sorry to derail us for a second, but this is actually something that was really bothering me, and I had no idea even what to search for. But remember back in, I'm going to say, the late aughts, early 10s, that format of text-to-speech where it was always like a man and a woman, and it was like often a bear talking to like another.
Yeah, like super lo-fi. You would just write a script, and it would be super yes. lo-fi beginning of a meme. And a counterpoint of a meme, answer to a meme, punchline.
Like I remember the one that I remember was as Android started getting better, it was just like the female voice was like, I want an iPhone. And the male voice was like, would you like apps? Yes. Would you like switching? Yes. Would you like Flash? Yes. You should get an Android. I want an iPhone.
Yes.
Like, it was that thing, but I have no idea what it's called, and I have no idea how to find it. And
if I remember correctly, it was like a four-letter word, like Mimo or something. I'm sure somebody will nail it. So, if it helps, I know exactly what you're talking about.
While we try to remember that name, what I think is fascinating is that this went from a thing that we said it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. When I built my Audiomatic platform for converting like books and stuff into audiobooks, one of the things that I just assumed was that I would be able to probably plug into, there was Microsoft has voice fonts, which is kind of like this, which has been around, but it's hard to use and whatnot. But I think something will come up with a simple version of this. And this, I'm actually supposed to talk to these people soon about their platform. But, you know, I figured this was coming. This is inevitable because you can look at where the code was coming. There's things like Tacotron as a code base for like emulating speech and these things. And there's just a lot of researchers working on doing this. We've talked before about a company called Descript, which uses parts of this. We're looking at, is this what you're talking about, Justin?
Extra yeah. normal. Extra That's normal. What it was. Extra normal. But those were always, that was the first time. The reason why I brought this up was because that was the first time where I remember the audio, the text to audio being clear enough that it now reminded you of a comedy bit, like in a way that I don't think was possible before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it certainly, even in a crude form, taking text and putting it into speech changes the way in which we experience it. And I like to swim in pudding because pudding's my favorite thing to swim in, naked, whatever. And then just a thing, Brian told me privately. And then I could put Brian, use deepfake, whatever, to put Brian's face over my face. And I could use this if, you know, ethically, they don't allow you to use somebody else's voice. But let's say we figured a way, we had the unethical version of this. And, you know, I could have Brian with his pudding confession just by doing it. And granted, right now, with people like, I think it looks like a deepfake. But 5 years from now, we wouldn't know.
Well, and so what happens to us sociologically where nobody believes anything? We all become cynical, not just skeptical, but cynical. Like it doesn't matter.
See, this is always where we diverge on the path, because I do believe we will always be able to tell. I think that is one thing that has matured as fast as the technology, is that we have had some kind of level. Now, that might break through, and I might be the Pollyanna in this, but I've always been a believer that we will have some kind of, even if it's frighteningly realistic, but what we will say is, oh my God, that sounds exactly like him, as opposed to, I have no idea whether or not this is him or her compared to their real voice.
I've watched some of the new computer simulation stuff of digital avatars, where they compare it to a real person and to a digital person. And the new gen, I can't tell the difference now. I cannot tell you which one's the digital and which one's real.
Now, maybe, I guess my issue has always been, it's not necessarily that we can't tell with the naked eye. I do think that we're going to get to that point. If we are not in many ways already there, but there will be a tell. Somebody will know, and we will culturally educate ourselves on those tells.
I don't think that's the case now. I mean, you're talking we have people fall every day from, we had a problem early on, email scams, where I could just put my name and I could spoof an email to somebody else, and that gets people. We get people being fooled all the time by voices they don't recognize. And then you have celebrity impersonators and stuff that can do pretty good voice versions of stuff. I think that the technology, the rate at which this stuff evolves, is you tell me what the tell is, and the AI will evolve past that. I think that's, we will get these papers this algorithm, we found a way to fool these AI image recognition systems. That was an image recognition system 5 years ago. Now that you told us there's a spoof, I put that in the data set, it don't work anymore.
Yeah, it feels to me like an antibody versus contagion perpetual face-off. That will always be the case. Recently, I was out when we were on vacation, and I was really surprised. I got a phone call from my area code in Austin, Texas. I hit answer, and the first sound was the Spectrum boo 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 that they always play whenever there's a phone call. Then a robotic voice started saying, hello, AT&T customer. So this is me, who is a customer of AT&T, who does have an account with Spectrum. And immediately the robot voice is giving me two clues that indicate that this is a relevant phone call. But then it veered into that stereotypical spam talk, where it's just like, there's a problem with your account. Call now and pay this big bill immediately, or real trouble awaits you. So that was an escalation in the, complexity of the attack. But I feel like whether it's our human responses continues to escalate and get better, or whether or not AI bots do better and better at filtering that stuff out, it's just going to be a perpetual battle.
Yeah, I think I've said this before, but I think we're going to need more secure systems of communication. An app. That's going to be, I think, a market in the future. It's going to be the app that, is harder to spoof. I get a FaceTime call from Justin. I know Justin initiated the call. And you have things like in the iPhone, they have the camera in the back, which scans the points on the face and stuff. There's a lot of little things you could do to say, one is to make sure it's harder to one, who's calling you is who's calling you. That's a problem right now with our phone system, is it's very, you did magic tricks like that, where you just spoof phone numbers. I could find out who the name of your friend, and I could use a spoofing tool to call you from their phone number.
Right.
And that's a big problem. And again, not to blame the phone company. It's not like when these things were first conceived that they were thinking of the acceleration of technology. So I think that's going to be step number one. It's just more secure forms of communication. So I know I get the call on the app, but I know who it's from. Other than that, anything in the media, I won't believe anything, which is where I am right now. So, gentlemen, one of your picks?
Sure. So I've been watching this show on Netflix. Well, first we finished the most recent Netflix season of Schitt's Creek. It's great. I encourage it. Then we started watching the second season of the Netflix series Sex Education. This is, I don't know, I'm sure, I don't know if it's Netflix exclusive out in Britain or if it's co-financed, but it takes place in England. It stars Asia Butterfield and Gillian Anderson, and it's about a famous sex therapist who wrote like one of those joy of sex kind of books in the 80s and 90s with her ex-husband and their child, who now is in high school, going through all the awkward high school things. But he is now this, sex therapist to his peers. And it's an interesting show. It's very, very well shot. And it has likable characters. But I think it best exists as kind of a PSA. I often find myself watching the show saying, I hope this is popular with the youth, because it really is a better way to explain things than I think often happens in just actual teenage life. And also, it takes place in high school and everybody's banging constantly, so everybody has to look 27 years old, which is another weird part about it. But I think we're all, you're happier in the end, considering how much nudity and sex is in the show, that nobody actually looks like they're in high school.
Right on. This is that awkward chicken game that me and Andrew just played of who wants to talk first about teenage sex.
The 80s, raunchy sort of comedy movies certainly skewed a lot of my understanding about how the world works.
Yeah, it was really wild. Like, I was talking to the girls about how in a pre-internet era, you had very few conduits to reach a lot of people. So as a result, if what you wanted to see was naked lady boobies, then it made sense to just throw some into your comedy, your college comedy movie, because, okay, maybe you're here for the naked lady boobies or maybe you're here for the comedy, but regardless, you're here. And also, we don't know of too many other ways for you to get your naked lady boobies or whatever. I don't know.
I would love to have been there when that conversation took place.
I mean, I'm sure that none of it happened at the surface, right? But almost certainly that was...
You with your kids. You with your kids, Brian.
Oh, whatever.
Kevin Smith talks about when he went from after Clerks, and then they were talking about Mallrats, and the pitch that he got from the studio was like, oh, you're the future. You're the new Meatballs. You're the new teen sex thing. So you gotta have boobs. You gotta have boobs. And he was at that time dating Joey Lauren Adams, and that's why there's that very weird scene in Mallrats where Joey Lauren Adams is changing, and you see her boobs, and then Kevin Smith's head comes through the wall. Was literally just because they wanted the random boob shot of the up and coming young starlet in the show and or in the movie. And Kevin Smith was really uncomfortable with it. Joey Lauren Adams was really uncomfortable with it. They were in the heightened uncomfortable level of also dating on top of being a director, writer, and star. So that was super crazy. And that's why, you know, like this show is so weird, because there's certainly a lot of gratuitous nudity. There's almost every episode opens with people having sex, and yet the lessons are often these like straight out of the textbook, like, ah, well, this is what this is doing, and this is, you know, the gender spectrum, or the, you know, what urges are natural, what urges aren't. Every episode seems to tick off the box of some element of actual sex education. So it is a weird show.
Ivan Reitman directed Meatballs. He turned out okay. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters, you know. Slimer had no pants on.
So on the flip side, from sex to violence, I'll give a recommendation to the movie 1917, World War One movie. I didn't know this going into it. All I knew is that it was generally positively reviewed, 89% on Rotten Tomatoes. About 10 minutes into the movie, I realized, oh, shoot, this is one of those movies where they're doing a magic trick. And the magic trick is the complete one-shot experience through the entire movie. You can kind of tell the moments that they're fuzzing some edges. But I liked it quite a bit. And I mean, it's war, so it's not exactly pretty. But I took my 12-year-old daughter, and we both enjoyed it quite a bit.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it. And I think this is one of those places where the single take was really justified. You know, I've seen that the faux take, the faux single take done a few times where you're like, one, it's not really a single take. Two, it doesn't do anything for the story. Like you just like, this was just so the director could go, look what we did, this single take. And it's like, no, you didn't. There are three cuts here. You did a cut here, here, and here. But anyhow, here, because it's the point of view of these soldiers,
correct,
going through the sequence of time, like I heard, I'm like, oh, this sounds like the perfect use for this, you know, for this kind of level of immersion.
And so. It is, because it forces you to experience those boring moments. Like in real life, to get from point A to point B, they had to fill the time with just chatting about nonsense or whatever. And it was kind of dull until all of a sudden it got really exciting in a terrifying way. And then it went back to being dull again. And you experience that as the movie goes. I liked it quite a bit.
And they punched a baby Yoda. Bryce?
I got a pick here. So last week, I think they had, they just wrapped up the Awesome Games Done Quick, the speedrunning live stream marathon that they do a couple of times a year now. And over the weekend, I actually spent a bit of time like watching the archives, because they put the archives of everything up on YouTube, so they make it really easy to watch all of these runs, and it's there's always good stuff. They got San Andreas. They did Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, which was a cool sort of 4-hour run. They have a task block, the tool assisted speed run, which we're looking at on the video version now, which is always a fun time, where they've made a computer. They've programmed a computer frame by frame to play these incredibly impossible video games. It's always a good time. Do any of you guys actually watch the Games Done Quick stuff?
I mainly know about it from your enthusiasm for it. I occasionally, for example, I remember watching like an original unpatched Fallout Quick speed run that I rather liked. But in general, unless I'm already familiar with the game, it's hard to get me excited about watching a fast version of a game I'm unfamiliar with.
Sure. They have tons of games. I mean, when they do these two big ones every year, it's 7 days straight of games. I think it's worth checking out. They have it. It's very easy to search on their YouTube stuff. So if you're interested, I'd say take a look. They've probably got something of your favorite game. One of the cool ones this year was the Fallout anthology. So they had one runner who went through Fallout 1, 2, 3.
Holy cow, back to Fallout 1 when it was a third-person perspective.
CRPG, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because those, once they go to 3D, then it's like a totally different game and you have to use different warps. But you also get to see how a lot of the same thing, the same exploits you would use in one type of game, transfer into the sequel because it's a similar engine. The other one is they do runs of Riven, the sequel to Myst, Real Myst, and Myst 3. So if you like Myst, actually let me pull it up, because it's fun seeing it, because they just click through so fast on everything, and it only stops when they, you know, have like animations in the actual game. So like
the cutscenes.
You're right.
My two favorite things about factoids about Myst are one, the original version of Myst they made on HyperCard, which was, you know, the Apple tool, which was for making very easy way to like do presentations and stuff, which, you know, Apple, you know, cast aside, which maybe for good reasons, whatever, but it was an amazing tool that you could let you kind of program and stuff. They did a HyperCard. And then Disney, we talked about, you know, Disney bought the rights to Myst to make an actual amusement park based on it.
Oh, wow. Really? Wow.
They have an island in one of their lakes, and the thought was as Universal or SeaWorld or whatever was opening, or SeaWorld was opening up this experience where you could dive with dolphins, which was a much more expensive ticketed experience. Disney was like, well, if people show up to go pay that, if they're getting $1,000 a day, a couple $1,000 a day for people to go do this, maybe we could do a really cool immersive experience. So they bought the rights to Myst with the plans that, like Disney does. Disney's developed so much stuff that just sits on the shelf. Like we talked about, like before, Brian, there were actually plans to put a Disney park on top of an aircraft carrier.
Wow.
And so the idea that there could have been a Myst theme park, you know, would have been cool.
Yeah,
that's insane.
So Games Done Quick, they have all of their old archives, all the old games. It's very cool. Easy to spend 20 hours or 20 minutes on it. That's my pick. Andrew?
So my pick is, you ever like, you start thinking about a movie and you go like, you know, I remember when I saw that movie, it was better than I expected. And, you know, years later, you're like, yeah, I'm going to go back and watch that again and see how it measures up. And I did that with Dante's Peak. You know, there was the summer of 1997 was when we had Volcano with Tommy Lee Jones and Dante's Peak with Pierce Brosnan, both movies involving volcanoes destroying cities in the West Coast. And Volcano was like, I think like kind of like the bigger sort of budget one, I believe. But Dante's Peak wasn't cheap either. And I remember enjoying Dante's Peak more, and partly because I could have issues with the story and certain things, but from a cinematic point of view, a focused story, the point is the small town near kind of like a Mount St. Helens-esque type volcano is about to explode. And it's a very interesting period in time because 1997, we were seeing a lot more computer effects in movies, and Dante's Peak had some CGI, but they still did a ton of models. And you watch a lot of the effects and they look really good because they would use like quarter scale cars and stuff. They built what they think the quote, like they built what was the largest miniature built, which was like a massive set of like a valley. They built like you see the like I watched behind the scenes. You see the volcano they built, the actual volcano they did to blow up themselves. This thing's like 50 feet wide, 40 feet tall, like this huge, huge structure. And when they wanted to do things like cars falling off bridges, they had these quarter scale cars set up on these bridges and stuff and were doing things like, you know, driving them off and exploding them and stuff. Yeah, we're looking at, that was an image we just saw, the volcano there. Like, if you look closely, you get a sense of scale. Like, a person can walk under that.
Wow.
You know, and we don't do things like that scale anymore here, as far as I know. And, you know, they would, they built like a big, huge water. They went out to like Van Nuys Airport and they got every scaffold they could in LA and further out to build a big platform to put a big water tank on top of so they could do the stuff. A lot of really amazing special effects. Some of them, you know, maybe look a little Toho Studios, but most of them are pretty good. and the story, it's neat. I enjoyed it. So Dante's Peak is my flashback. Go back and check it out. Roger Donaldson directed.
That run of disaster, late 90s disaster movies that, you know, because then right after that, the next year you get the big Deep Impact, Armageddon battle. But man, we were really into the big horrifying thing that was going to happen.
Yeah. Actually, Dante's Peak had a higher budget than Volcano. Did not know that. That was just, yeah, weird, interesting time. You know, that was I have an anecdote about why I knew somebody who worked on the Jurassic Park films. And they pointed out why Jurassic Park 2 had the big boat that crashed into the dock?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think I've heard this story because they were against Godzilla and somebody was like, we're going to have the best of all worlds, just throw in a scene of a T-Rex running through a city and also a boat crash. Speed 2, I think was
Speed 2, yep. That's it. Yeah, Godzilla and Speed 2. So on a boat that ran into a dock, a Godzilla popped out and ran through San Diego.
And that came from it was Spielberg who was like, if they're going to do this, if they're going to put a movie out against my movie this summer, then I'm going to have, you know, if they're going to have Godzilla, I'm going to have, it was just Spielberg. That was Spielberg being his most Spielbergian and be like, well, I'm going to outdo them with all of this stuff. And so you get this boat crash.
That's in amazing.
Jurassic Park. Like, oh, okay, cool. Gentlemen, been weird.
They cut you from the gymnastics team.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.